Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Esther chapter 2, which I will call Mordecai Discovers a Plot After Esther Becomes Queen. Our context is this: in Esther chapter 1, the previous chapter, we see the Persian king Xerxes ask his queen Vashti to come into a drunken banquet and to display her beauty. She gets angry. She refuses to do it. King Xerxes, under the influence of wine and alcohol, then agrees to depose her and divorce her, and now he's got to find another queen. So that's our context. We go to Esther 2, verses 1 through 4. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's attendants, who served him, said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to the citadel of Susa, to the harem, into the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given them. Then let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in place of Vashti." And the matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly. Now in verse 1, we read, after these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had subsided. That sounds to me like it's a few days after the effects of the wine he drank at his banquet had worn off, and he'd gotten over his anger at Vashti for not coming in there to display her beauty to his drunken friends with her crown on her head. So after his hangover, he then remembered Vashti and what she had done, and his decree against her, which is basically a divorce decree. Now, there's another option as to when this happened, not just a few days after his hangover had worn off, but it could be after his expedition into Greece to fight the famous battles of Salamis, which he lost in 380 BC, and Plataea, which his armies lost in 379 BC. Because we know that after he lost Salamis, which was a disastrous defeat, he gave himself up to his amours, he quit worrying about military glory. He went back to Persia, stopped in Sardis in Asia Minor on the way. He fell in love there with his brother's wife and then with his brother's daughter, as John Gill tells us, which is pretty sick. So that would sound like, yeah, it's time for me to find a new queen. Well, maybe so, but I'm just going to think that the time here is right after the banquet. So he remembers what happened. He remembers what had been decreed against Vashti. She has to be divorced. Maybe he has a change of heart now. Maybe he says, "Oh, I was drunk. I'll forgive Queen Vashti for that." But the problem is, he had this decree against Vashti written down according to the laws of the Medes and the Persians. Those laws could not be revoked. They were permanent. Couldn't get rid of them. So he's got to find a new wife. So they have a virgin beauty contest. All over the country, they're going to look for young virgins. They even had special overseers appointed. "What's your job?" "My job is to look for the beautiful young virgins in my province to ship off to Susa so that the Emperor Xerxes can satisfy his lust." So all these virgins are brought into Susa, into the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch. Eunuchs, of course, were in charge of the harem. And then the text says, "Let their cosmetics be given them." Well, those cosmetics would, of course, include fragrant oils, as Gill and Clark point out. And why would cosmetics be given to the virgins? Because if the barn needs painting, you need to paint it. Need to doll them up to satisfy the sensual desires of Xerxes. So that was the idea the king's servants, courtiers, suggested to Xerxes. And he said, "That's a good idea." And so he did it. So we go now to Esther 2, 5 through 6. "Now there was at the citadel in Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled." Now this date of the exile of whoever this is, it's not clear whether it's Mordecai or whether it's Jair, Shimei, son of Kish. It could have been Kish who was exiled. We do know the exile that's being talked about is not the 586 exile, but it's the 597 exile, because that's when Jeconiah was taken into exile. Jeconiah is another name, by the way, for Jehoiakim. Sometimes he's also called Kaniah, That was in 597. Now, if it was Mordecai that was taken into exile in 597, that would make Mordecai about 114 years old, because 597 minus 483, because the banquet was in the third year of Xerxes' reign, and he started reigning in 486. So that's 597 minus 483. That's 114 years old. That's pretty old for Mordecai. We know that Mordecai was Esther's cousin, and if Esther was his first cousin, then they would be about the same age. It's hard to imagine a 114-year-old beautiful virgin to win the beautiful virgins contest. So how do we solve this problem? Well, the easiest way to solve it is that it was not Mordecai who was exiled from Jerusalem in 597, but it was some man named Kish who was exiled. So we can read it this way. Now there was at the citadel in Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem. Not Mordecai, who had been taken into exile, but Kish, in which case we've got no problem. There's another way you could reconcile it, too. You could say that Esther was a second cousin, not a first cousin of Esther. By the way, how do we know that Esther is a cousin of Mordecai? We read that in verse 15 of this chapter, which we're not there yet. Esther 2:15. Now, when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai. So if Esther is the daughter of an uncle, that makes her a cousin. But it doesn't say whether she's the daughter of Abihail, the uncle. Well, it does say the uncle, but uncle could be great uncle. So she could have been the daughter of a great uncle, making Esther a second cousin, Esther having been born a good time before Mordecai, the first cousin. Well, I think it's just easier to say this is Kish, who was exiled in 597, and Mordecai was the descendant of Kish. Now, if this Kish were the original Kish, the father of Saul, that would make Mordecai a descendant of Saul. Now, if you take this Kish as Saul's father, that would make Mordecai of the house of Saul. We know that Shimei, who's listed here in verse 5, Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, he was the guy that cursed David when David was fleeing Absalom from Jerusalem. And Kish would then be Saul's father, and that would be important because Haman was a descendant of Agag. We'll find out in the next chapter, the enemy of the Jews, Haman. And, of course, Mordecai was the enemy of Haman, and therefore Mordecai would be a house of Saul, and Saul's house was an enemy of Agag, Haman's house. So it would be a conflict of generations going on here, contrast of tribes, not just a contest between two people, Mordecai and Haman. Well, all of that is very, very speculative. Some people even speculate that Mordecai, after his exile in 597, then came back to Jerusalem because of Ezra 2:2 in the list there. There came with Zerubbabel ... Mordecai. Well, that's probably a different Mordecai, some people say. So this is all speculation. So we'll take it all with a grain of salt as exactly what Mordecai's roots were, and move now to Esther 2, verse 7. He, that's Mordecai, was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had no father or mother. Now the young lady was beautiful of form and face, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. Now Hadassah is Esther's Hebrew name, as the NIV Study Bible points out. Esther was her Persian name. Well, what does her Persian name mean? Well, there's speculation on that. Some say her name might be related to the Persian Stara, which means star. So Esther means Estara, star. This is NIV Study Bible of Gil. Some say her name might be related to Ishtar, the Babylonian goddess of love and fertility. That's the famous Astarte. I would hate to think that she was named after Ishtar, the Easter egg Ishtar, the many-breasted Ishtar. If you ever seen her statue, she's ugly as sin. She's not beautiful of form and face. Or some people say that Esther is her name is related to the Persian Satar, which means hidden, because she was hidden in the house of Mordecai. I think that's a stretch. I don't know what Esther means, but Hadassah means myrtle, and I guess the idea is she's beautiful as a myrtle tree. I've never thought of a myrtle tree as being beautiful. I live 3 hours from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, sort of a famous vacation place on the coast, and I've never once thought about the myrtle trees there being beautiful. They have little purple flowers, if I remember correctly. But at any rate, Esther is a beautiful young girl. Now, why do we call this book Esther instead of the book of Hadassah? Why was her name Esther used and not Hadassah? Well, Esther concealed her nationality and family background. The name Esther did that. We read in verse 10 in this chapter, chapter 2, Esther did not make known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had instructed her that she should not make them known. Now, that would make sense that Mordecai would not want Esther's Jewish minority status known. Haman's subsequent persecution of the Jews showed it was very reasonable to be quiet about being a Jew. And if her name was Hadassah, everybody would know, hey, that's a Jew. So she's named Esther. Remember, Daniel had two names too. His Babylonian name was Belteshazzar. So this is not surprising. We go now to Esther 2, verses 8 and 9. So it came about when the command and decree of the king were heard, and many young ladies were gathered to the citadel of Susa into the custody of Hegai, that Esther was taken to the king's palace into the custody of Hegai, who was in charge of the women. Now the young lady pleased him and found favor with him. So he quickly provided her with cosmetics and food, gave her 7 choice maids from the king's palace, and transferred her and her maids to the best place in the harem. Now this keeper of the concubines, I've been calling him Hegai, could say Hegai. If Mordecai is Mordecai, then Hegai could be Hegai because it's AI at the end. I never know how to pronounce that. Is it Isaiah or is it Isaiah? But I'm going to call him Hegai. He was pleased. Verse 9 says the young lady pleased him, i.e. Hegai, not the king, but Hegai. I was a little confused about that. I looked at the pool commentary who made it clear that it's Hegai, not the king, who was pleased by Esther. He was so pleased that he gave Esther 7 maidens to take care of her, 1 for each day of the week, I suppose. And then Hegai gave Esther and her maids the best place in the harem. Now, as the NIV Study Bible points out, it is ironic that Vashti's decree, her divorce decree, was supposed to help women show proper respect for their husband. Remember, the decree said that nowhere in the nation shall a man who is married to a woman who's not speaking the man's language, in that family the man's language will be used, not the woman's language. And Vashti is being punished for her insubordination to her husband, and that's supposed to be a good example for everybody else in the empire. Respect for their husband. Well, what kind of respect should Xerxes get as a husband, because he's forcibly abducting young virgins as sex slaves, as the NIV Study Bible points out? Esther, who was a good Jewish girl, was not in the harem by her choice. She was forced in there. That's not the way you gain respect as a husband. Now, a harem in the Eastern culture did not merely contain concubines to have sex with. They were children of concubines in the harem. They were servants, of course, of the concubines, as in Esther's case. They were even prepubescent boys in the harems, children of the concubines. There were also female relatives of the king, for example, the king's mothers, the king's sisters, the king's daughter. They lived in the harem too. And after looking around on the internet a little bit, I realized that a lot of people have exaggerated what goes on in a harem because of its secrecy, and so you can say whatever you want about it, and so people come up with all these salacious tales about all the sexual goings on in a harem. Not necessarily quite that way. In fact, I read in one place that the Sultan couldn't even pick the women in the harem that he wanted to have sex with. His mother picked the girl that was to come to the king at night. But at any rate, Esther's sitting pretty in the harem. Now we go to verse 10 and 11 in Esther 2. Esther did not make known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had instructed her that she should not make them known. And we said, why? Because of all the potential anti-Jewish sentiment at the court at that time. Remember in chapter 9, there were a ton of Jewish enemies that Mordecai had to deal with. We'll get there in chapter 9. All getting ready to kill Jews all over the empire. In fact, Esther might never had become queen if it had been known that she was Jewish. Now in verse 11, every day Mordecai walked back and forth in front of the court of the harem. Why? Because he couldn't go in. A harem was an inviolable sanctuary. Only eunuchs could go in, castrated, so they couldn't have sex with the concubines, and so the king didn't have to worry about them. Now he could go close to the harem because he was a court official. He could get as close as he did get, as John Gill points out. So we go now to Esther 2, verses 12 through 14. Now when the turn of each young lady came to go in to King Ahasuerus, after the end of her 12 months under the regulations for the women, for the days of their beautification were completed as follows: 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and the cosmetics for women. The young lady would go into the king in this way. Anything that she desired was given her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go in, and in the morning she would return to the second harem, to the custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the concubines. She would not again go into the king unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. Now in verse 12, we learn something about the customs of the harem. 12 months the young virgins were beautified. Why did it take so long, 12 months? Well, this is John Gill tells us why. First of all, to make sure that the virgins were thoroughly beautiful. I imagine if you have a beautiful young girl soaked in oil of myrrh for 6 months and then rubbed with spices for another 6 months and rubbed with cosmetics and practice and with the ladies practicing on how to get the cosmetics on her, that's a year of beauty school. So I guess they were thoroughly beautiful at the end of 12 months. It could be a ritual designed to make it awesome that Xerxes possessed such women. I'm the emperor, and my women have to be beautified for 12 months before I can even look at them. But you, as a common person, can't do that with your women. Or there's another reason why they had to spend, these beautiful young virgins had to spend 12 months in the harem before they saw the king, was to make sure that the virgins were really virgins and they weren't pregnant. We couldn't have a member of the harem having sex with the king and getting pregnant, and then somebody saying, well, that's not really the king's son. And, of course, they're not going to get pregnant if they're in a harem for 12 months because the only men that are in there are prepubescent boys and eunuchs, and they can't have sex. I'm going to read you something funny from Adam Clark as to the reason why, in his opinion, the women were kept in the harem for 12 months. Quote, "The most beautiful of all the young virgins of all the provinces of Babylon were to be selected, and these were taken out of all classes of the people, indiscriminately. Consequently, there must have been many who were brought up in low life. Now, we know that those who feed on coarse, strong food, which is not easily digested, have generally a copious perspiration, which is strongly odorous. And in many, though in every respect amiable and even beautiful, this odor is far from being pleasant. Pure, wholesome, easily digested, and nourishing aliment, that's food, with the frequent use of the hot bath, continued for 12 months, the body frequently rubbed with olive oil, will in almost every case remove all that is disagreeable of this kind. This treatment will give a healthy action to all the subcutaneous vessels, and in every respect promote health and comfort." Only Adam Clark could come up with that. He's basically saying they had to get rid of body odor. So they had to rub them down in oil for 12 months. But anyway, they were beautified for 12 months. And now they were not only rubbed down with oil and spices for 12 months, they are trained in how to have good sex with the king. Now, I read that somewhere a long time ago, and I can't find the quote. But I wouldn't doubt that in the least. Now, when they go into their big night with the king, they left the harem and they could carry with them anything, it says in verse 13. Now, anything could include ornaments, jewels, clothes. John Gill suggests maybe any person she wanted to go with her, like a handmaiden, maybe musical instruments, anything to please the king. Now, in verse 14, it says that once the king is finished with her, she would go in the morning after she had sex with him. She would return to the second harem, to the custody of Shashgaz. What's this second harem? This is the harem for those who had been made secondary wives or concubines, as opposed to the first harem, which was full of virgins in waiting. In other words, the king would just have sex with women who had no legal attachment to him, young girls who had no legal attachment to him. He got those from the first harem. Once he had sex with them, they were no longer virgins, so he would put them in the secondary harem, and the secondary harem contained concubines because they had some kind of official relationship with the king. They were no longer just girls. They were concubines. So they graduated, so to speak, to the second harem. Now, if the king wanted to call them back because he was specially pleased with them, that means he would make them queen, and so they would graduate to the status of queen. Now, in verse 14, we read, she would not again go in to the king unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. So the king says, her sex was ordinary. I'll just leave her there in the second harem. she would have to stay there chaste, no husband, for the rest of her life. Maybe she doesn't think that's a bad deal. I mean, after all, you get all your food taken care of, but it seems to me it'd be pretty boring to live in a secondary harem for the rest of your life. So if you want to become queen, you've really got to perform sexually for the king in your one night. You got a one-night stand, and you got to really make him happy. Just think, what if that king was in a bad mood that night? You don't have a chance. This is a pretty sick Persian custom, in my humble opinion. The secondary harem was managed by a man named Shashgaz. I love these Persian names. Adam Clark gives a couple of options as to what Shashgaz means. It can mean beardless, because eunuchs don't wear beards. Or it could mean weak loins, because eunuchs were castrated and their loins could not produce children. Well, whatever. Shashgaz. We go now to Esther 2, verses 15 and 16. Now, when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, came to go into the king, she did not request anything except what Hegai, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the women, advised. And Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is in the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Now, I've already discussed whether the uncle of Mordecai, Abihail, was the uncle or great-uncle. I'm just going to assume he's the uncle and that Mordecai is the first cousin of Esther. Now, when it was Esther's big night to go in with the king, she did not request anything. Remember, she was allowed to take anything she wanted to go see the king, but she didn't request anything except what Hegai, in charge of the first harem, what he suggested that she take. Now, why did she request anything to go see the king? Here's some options suggested by Gill and Clark. First of all, perhaps she didn't care whether the king liked her or not. So she says, I'm not going to take anything. I'm not going to take any special clothes. I'm not going to take any special perfume. I'm being forced against my will to go have sex with this guy. And I don't care what he thinks about it. Send me to the secondary harem. I don't care. Or it could be that she just didn't need anything else to carry to the king. John Gill says her virtue, her modesty, and her beauty were sufficient in themselves. She didn't need to doll herself up that much. I think the best option is Adam Clark's option, which he just says, well, she just relied on Hegai's judgment. Hegai would know more about what the king would like than she would, so tell me, Hegai, what should I carry in there? I really do want to please the king. I don't want to be put into the secondary harem for the rest of my life. That's all speculation, but that's reasonable, I think. At the end of verse 15, we read that Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. I think we've already seen that once. John Gill says, how did she do that? With her beauty, her innocent and modest look, and her graceful mien and deportment. She could have also been a nice girl, too. You know, character might have something to do with this. So in verse 16, Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus to his royal palace. So, of course, she's not taken from... Well, this is my speculation. She was probably taken from the first harem to Xerxes' place. And then some people say he was so pleased with her, he said, okay, I want you to be my queen so you don't have to go to the second harem. Well, it could be that she goes from the first harem to the king's palace, has sex with Ahasuerus, and then she goes to the second harem. And then Ahasuerus calls her back and says, I think I want you to be my queen. However it happened, she's queen now. She's not a perpetual widow in the second harem. She passed the test. Now, she was called into the royal palace to be queen in the 10th month, which is Tebeth. That's T-E-B-E-T-H. Sometimes you'll see that month written as T-E-V-E-T, Tebeth, or Tebeth. Depends on how you want to transliterate it. That's the 10th month of the Jewish religious year, December or January. The name Tebeth, or Tevet, comes from the Jewish calendar, not the Persian calendar, as Wikipedia tells us. This was in the 7th year of King Xerxes' reign. Now, we recall that it was in the 3rd year of Xerxes' reign that he divorced Vashti. That's when his banquet was. We read that in chapter 1. This is the 7th year, so it took 4 years to go from that banquet to Esther being queen. What happened in those 4 years? John Gill suggests that the 4 years in between may be when Xerxes was prepping for his war with Greece. That would explain why Xerxes took so much time finding a new wife. But there were other things that had to be done after Vashti's divorce. Esther would have to be discovered in order to participate in the Virgin Beauty Contest. The people had to go out and the officials had to go out and look through Persia. Let's find some virgins. Let's get the agreement with their parents. Let's get it all worked out. That's going to take time. And then, of course, when she got chosen for the first harem, she would have to be rubbed down with oil and spices for a year, as we read in verse 12. And then she would have to wait to be called into Xerxes' palace as Xerxes went through his virgins one at a time to see which one he preferred to be his queen. So that's not surprising that it took 4 years for Esther to become king. So we're going to assume now that this is in 479 or so B.C., because Xerxes took charge of the kingdom of Persia in 486. 7 years from that would put us at about 479 B.C. That, again, is based on a lot of speculation, but just that would also be the same year that Plataea was lost to Xerxes. So Esther had a lot of cheering up duties to do to cheer up her husband. Esther 2:17 through 18. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and his servants. He also made a holiday for the provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty. Now the king loved Esther more than all the women. That would be all the other women in the Virgin Beauty Contest that had been chosen and then discarded and put into the second harem and become the king's concubines. But Esther was a cut above the concubines. She was queen because she found favor and kindness with Xerxes. Now when it says that Esther found favor more than all the virgins, I'm assuming that's all the virgins who Xerxes had had sex with and put into the second concubine. But it could be that she found favor more than all the virgins in the harem, both those in the second harem with whom Xerxes had had sex, and also all the virgins in the first harem, the virgins-in-waiting harem, with whom he had not had sex with. It didn't matter anymore. According to that view, Xerxes was happy with who he had, Esther. He didn't need to try out all these other virgins in the first harem. He tried out enough. Verse 18 says, the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet. The Septuagint says it lasted 7 days. The Hebrew does not. For all his princes and his servants, he also made a holiday for the provinces. Now, John Gill says this was a tax holiday. This was the custom of the kings of Persia when they came to the throne to say, okay, you're not going to have to pay taxes for a whole year. Now, Adam Clark goes further and says that a Persian king would give a city to the queen, and what that meant was the city would have to take their tax revenues and give it to the queen. Let me read from Adam Clark. For they gave them such a city to buy them clothes, another city for their hair, a third city for their necklaces, a fourth city for their pearls. It is probable that, on this occasion, Esther so wishing, he relieved those cities and provinces which had before paid this queen gold from all these expenses, and this would tend greatly to make the queen popular. Kind of interesting custom to give your wife the tax revenues from a whole city just for one element of her apparel, for her pearls, for her hairpiece. Verse 18, Xerxes gave gifts according to the king's bounty. Well, who did he give gifts to? Well, it could be he gave gifts back to the provinces, or he could have given gifts to his local nobles in the city in Susa, or he could have given gifts to Esther, those gifts of the whole cities to their wives, as John Gill points out. Socrates speaks of a whole country in Persia that's called the Queen's Girdle, because the city gave its revenues to buy the queen a girdle. Another city was called her headdress, because the city gave its revenues to buy the queen's headdress. This is in Plato's Alcibiades, famous dialogue of Plato. Next time you read Alcibiades, look for that. I've read Alcibiades. I didn't notice that. It's kind of interesting. We go now to Esther 2, verses 19 through 20. When the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not yet made known her kindred or her people, even as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther did what Mordecai told her as she had done when under his care. Now the virgins were gathered together the second time. Probably the first time was when you had the gathering of virgins in the first harem, when Xerxes was trying to find a queen and he chose Vashti from all those virgins. That would be the first time he gathered virgins to make Vashti his queen, and now the second time he gathered virgins was when he made Esther his queen. Now, John Gill speculates another possibility is this is just another collection of virgins after Esther was made queen, merely to satisfy Xerxes' lust. Well, that's a speculation I don't think is true. But right about this time that Esther was being chosen for queen, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Now, what was he sitting at the king's gate for? Remember, the gate of a city is where commercial and legal business is transacted. This, of course, shows that Mordecai, or it tends to show that Mordecai was a king's official. There are other reasons, too, that we know that Mordecai was an official in Xerxes' government. Ancient Persian records indicate a minor official named Mardukiah. Now, Mardukiah sounds an awful lot like Mordecai, does it not? Also, we know, this is from the NIV Study Bible, that Mordecai was associated with court officials. In our next chapter, chapter 3, verses 2 through 4, we read this. All the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage, so he's singled out as one of the king's officials who did not bow down to Haman. We also know that Mordecai knows what's going on in the palace. At the last several verses of this chapter, we're going to see him exposing a conspiracy, which means he would have to be an official to know about that, most probably. And also, we read in Esther 4 this. So Hathach went out to Mordecai to the city square in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Well, that's court business. Haman knew it. He even knew to the exact penny how much Haman had promised to pay Xerxes after he destroyed the king's Jews. Mordecai also gave Hathach a copy of the text of the edict which had been issued in Susa for the Jews' destruction. Now that proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that Mordecai was indeed an official in Xerxes' government. He was at the king's gate. It's likely that his position in Xerxes' government would keep him at the gate, as the NIV Study Bible says. We read in verse 20, Esther had done what Mordecai told her, and she kept her ethnic identity secret. Verse 10 said, Esther did not make known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had instructed her that she should not make them known. And verse 20 reaffirms that she had not done that. Again, why? To prevent Esther from getting in trouble, because there's so much anti-Jewish prejudice in the empire. Also, to prevent envy of the Jews by the Persians. The Persians would say, well, the king took a foreigner. He took a Jew as his queen. We have all these beautiful Persian virgins that he could have chosen. And then, of course, now you've got ethnic strife. So Esther kept quiet which ethnicity she was. We go now to Esther 2, verses 21 through 23. In those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. But the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Now when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they, that's Bigthan and Teresh, were both hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence. Now, Bigthan and Teresh guarded the king's door. That's probably the door of the king's bedchamber. They were probably the king's bodyguards. Perfect people to be in on a plot to kill the king because they have access to the king and they can kill him relatively easy. They became angry for some reason. Here's some options as to why. Maybe they were partisans of the deposed Queen Vashti. Maybe they figured they would lose their places with the ascension of Queen Esther. Maybe Esther will fire them, in other words. Kind of like after the business merger and the people who used to work in the company all get fired when new management comes in. That might be why they were angry. Adam Clark speculates that Bigthan and Teresh could have been agents of Haman, and Haman might have been conspiring to get the throne. Who knows? Doesn't really matter. They were involved in a plot to kill Ahasuerus. Now, Esther informs Ahasuerus of the plot, and she does the informing in Mordecai's name. Why? So she would ingratiate Mordecai to the king. That's her first cousin, and she wants him, as a Jewish advisor to the king, to get credit for uncovering this plot. So she told the king, Mordecai told me about Bigthan and Teresh. You need to do something. Mordecai told me this. Now the plot was found. They were hanged on a gallows. Now, that hanged might not be hanged, it might be impaled. A note to the NIV translation says this, or were hung or impaled on poles. Similarly, elsewhere in Esther. Depends on your translation. Here's what Adam Clark says about this. Perhaps the words, he goes through the Hebrew words there, maybe the Hebrew words mean they were hung upon wood or a tree, but they may refer to their being impaled. A pointed stake is set upright in the ground, and the culprit is taken, placed on the sharp point, and then pulled down by his legs till the stake that went in at the fundament, that's a nice 19th century way of saying your rear end, the stake that went in at the fundament passes up through the body and comes out by the side of the neck, a most dreadful species of punishment, in which revenge and cruelty may glut the utmost of their malice. The culprit lives a considerable time in excruciating agonies. Yowza. I hope Queen Esther didn't get to see this. I'd feel a little bad about putting somebody through a crucifixion. Well, not a crucifixion, but a execution like that. Now, all this conspiracy of Bigthan and Teresh was written down in the Book of the Chronicles. That's not our biblical Book of Chronicles. This is Chronicles of the Persian Empire. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Esther chapter 2. In our next audio, we'll take up Esther chapter 3, and we will see Haman plotting against the Jews. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.